This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Love's Lady's Lost, revisiting Arthurian legend.
Now, dear listeners, I came up with that title.
She really wants the credit for it.
I want the credit for it because it's a terrible pun. And I put it in front of Jules, and Jules didn't hear the pun.
I just didn't. But that's probably more to do with my brain than it is to do with you, so don't take it personally.
Well, she made me feel crap about it, so I hope someone else gets it, because otherwise I will feel embittered that I can't come up with decent, cringeworthy enough puns.
Look, in all fairness, I went back and I refreshed the links on my website to all of our episodes, and I laughed my ass off when I came across Yay or Nay, Horses in Speculative Fiction, and that was definitely your workmanship. So you absolutely can do decent puns, it's just that my brain is not registering them right now.
In fairness to us both, we're both quite tired. End of a long weekend, what can you say?
Yeah. Now, almost 2 years ago, we did an episode called Merlin, Mordred and Morgana, Magic in Arthurian Legend. And I'm sure we strayed off the beaten track a little bit, but it was mostly around the magical idea, the druidry and everything set up around Arthurian legend and what fed into it.
Our conclusion from that episode was that we'd bitten off more than we could chew, and that we would have to revisit the subject. We feel that having gotten through about 2 years worth of content, it's probably safe for us now to return to the Arthurian legends without, you know, fear of you guys saying, but you've already done an episode on it.
Yeah, which we absolutely have, but we didn't really talk about the female role, I suppose, in Arthurian legend, and it is an important one, both when you're looking at some of the original source material, when you're looking at the 14th century, slightly romanticised but moralistic versions of that source material, and when you're looking at everything that's come since then that has been based on those two sources and a few others besides.
Now, quiz for you, dear listener. How many female characters from Arthurian legend can you name? I'm going to give you 10 seconds, okay? 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now, hopefully you managed to get more than 3, but it is possible that you didn't actually manage to get any more than that. That's because, on first glance, trying to identify female characters in Arthurian legends, which are a bit of a, you know, boys' club, can be quite difficult. That being said, as Jules has so rightly pointed out, the women in the Arthurian court were actually rather important to the entirety of the plot, because either they were causing the doom or the downfall of somebody, or they were the ones really messing stuff up.
Yeah, and I think it is important to look at, you know, diverse sources as well. I mean, if you look at sort of what we got left with in there's shreds of it in the Mabinogion, there's shreds of it in Irish mythology and Scottish mythology, and what passes for English, British mythology, still present. And it echoes Celtic myth. So that's one route. And then if you look at how a lot of it was rewritten during the Dark Ages, during the Middle Ages, basically.
Yeah, during different invasion periods.
during different invasion periods, when they were really trying to push this idea of, succor, valour and honour, the courtly ideals of being a knight, that it was a beautiful duty as well as a privilege. And a lot of that was to do with the fact that not every knight could be a landsknecht. So, you know, not every knight was going to have land and people. Sometimes it really was an empty title. And a good way of getting around that was, well, this is a very honourable thing to do. We'll give you armour and a horse and we'll send you off to fight wars for us, and you might win enough money to buy yourself land holdings and people.
Yeah.
And then added on to that was the idea of personification of the courtly duties and qualities in poetry and in verse and, you know, story as women. So a lot of the women who appeared in those sort of 13th, 14th century stories, who are female characters, were actually personifications of qualities they expected nobility to actually possess.
Yes. And therein sort of lies the problem.
Yes, it's quite difficult to then separate out the threads of, you know, any potential historical aspect that is actually true and easy to follow, or even difficult to follow, or whether it was based on a real person at all, what was added in, what was put in there as a morality tale.
Yes. I think probably one of the big problems that we have when we try to identify female characters in Arthurian legend is to find a female character in Arthurian legend who doesn't ultimately do wrong, isn't ultimately a villain in some form of or another. Can you name one, Jules, who doesn't, according to the doctrine of the Arthurian legends, you know, fuck shit up? Excuse my language.
I'm sure I've probably got a broader definition of what actually constitutes wrongdoing than some of the people who put this shit together.
Yeah. No, I realise that, but I mean within the doctrine, within the legend itself,
no,
you know.
Not really. I mean, I suppose the closest I can go is to say Vivian, but then Vivian was strongly lent towards being a political player.
Yeah.
So in some legends, she's kind of like the hand that moves the king. And in some, she's kind of like, well, actually, she's a disembodied entity that lives at the bottom of a lake, so...
Depending
on who's telling the story.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's the whole what she does with Merlin. And the other thing is that different female characters, a little bit like some of the lesser knights within the legends, are interchanged with one another. So we have Vivian, we have Nimue. Sometimes they're the same person, sometimes they're different people. Sometimes Vivian is the Lady of the Lake and sometimes she isn't. The problem is that there's a lot of material which has been adapted from source material, other mythologies, and propaganda. So over time, also fan fiction, monks writing a lot of fan fiction, over time things have changed. And I think predominantly now when we look at the Arthurian legends, they were incredibly influenced by religious elements, and also during two periods of history, where there was a national crisis and a national sense of identity in question, which was also tied in with monarchy. And that was the Tudor, Stuart era, and the Victorian era, both times of which mythology became very popular again, and particularly Arthurian legend. And we see that a lot in the poetry that was coming out during the Victorian era in Tennyson, as well as a lot of other sort of epic poets. And once again, as you said, Jules, there was this real emphasis on courtly love, and on the purity of this kind of chivalry. But it was also about punishing women. And there has always kind of been, since the religious aspect in particular stepped in, the punishment of powerful women, in that Morgana, for instance, and we've mentioned her before, but she is an incredibly prominent woman, obviously, within the Arthurian legends. Morgana starts out in the very original version as a healer, and she is on Arthur's side. As time goes on, she becomes an evil sorceress. She gets merged with her sister Morgause. And becomes the mother of Mordred, because heaven forbid there'd be two powerful women.
Yeah.
No, we only have room for one. They get merged. A child gets produced. The child is pure evil because the child has been indoctrinated by their mother.
Yeah. And see, I suppose the thing there is you can see things like Beowulf feeding into it.
Yeah.
And that's when the Saxon thread came in as well. Because I've read versions where Morgus was actually Morgana's and Arthur's aunt.
Yeah.
And Vivian's sister. So, you know, tight knit family. Very tight knit family since
then has very tight knit
her brother's child.
maybe a bit too tight knit, guys.
But yeah, I mean, we've talked about this before, and I will mention it again, although I'm pretty sure that a lot of our listeners are going to go, ick. But under Celtic tradition, in order to keep bloodlines pure, they would marry brother and sister together. And yep. It would have been expected for Morgana, or, you know, in some stories, her twin sister, Morgus, to marry Arthur, their half-brother, and be queen, because you could only really track who should be king through the matrilineal line. So a king would not have heirs, but his sister would, because you knew where her children had come from.
Yeah, I do like that. Yeah, absolutely, no doubt, that's definitely your child.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? They didn't have DNA testing back then, so even if you weren't marrying brother to sister, you were saying that your nephew was more likely to be, you could absolutely be sure that he had come from the same royal line as you, whereas you couldn't with your wife, really.
And no.
The thing is, that wasn't necessarily a crime. It was more of an issue for women to not have children if they wanted them than it was for them to go off and sleep with other people in order to get pregnant, in order to produce children.
Yeah.
This all changed. This changed first with, you know, the Saxons, and then it changed again with the Norman conquest of 1066, and that's where the real punishment of women came into it, I think.
Yeah, definitely. The versions of Arthur that we see now are definitely influenced by the Norman conquest. Even within The Sword and the Stone, there is this definite it's even stated, they are Norman. Arthur is Norman, and there is a Saxon influence because they happen to have Robin Hood there as well, and he's Saxon.
Sorry, excuse me a moment while I just wipe my nosebleed away, because I've got a real issue with the timeline.
I just thought you were getting excited about Robin Hood. I know why I was.
Not unless he really was a fox.
No, Jules, no!
Disney
you
Fox.
Don't admit that!
I think we've admitted it a few times now, Madeline. Our secret's out.
Oh, he was a good fox. Yeah. Anyway, before this escalates, it was definitely influenced by the Norman conquest, and even to the point that actually a lot of the visuals that we get for the Arthurian court are around the Norman conquest or the Tudor era or then the Victorian era. But the Victorians sort of put them in Renaissance kind of Tudor clothes, really.
Yes.
Because that was far back enough. Also, this was probably influenced by a lot of the paintings that were happening at the time. For instance, the recommission of the Round Table in Winchester. I should hasten to add, it is obviously not the real Round Table, though you'd be surprised how many guests come to Winchester and go, wow, that's King Arthur's real Round Table. And no, it was from the 12th century, I believe, and it was used during large parties and tournaments where they would all pretend to be King Arthur and his group for fun, because it was very enjoyable at the time. Henry VIII then had the table recommissioned to sort of be painted and fixed up. And he had Arthur painted in his own image.
As you do.
There was kind of 16th century
cosplay.
Yeah, it really was. And obviously there were no women painted along with it. And there were no women included on the Round Table. Because heaven forbid. But women were present. Now, Morgana was just one of several women who were obviously part of Arthur's court. We've already talked about the fact that she was demonized, so let's just put Morgana away to the side for a minute, and let's talk about some of the other pure lily-white women we can find in Arthur's court. So if we just move a couple of the knights out of the way, yeah, just pop Sir Percival on the bench there and move. Aha! We have come across our first pure lily white woman. She wasn't actually part of Arthur's court, really. We have Isolde.
Yes, it's sort of, the legends really were probably concurrent, and you know, they may well have drawn on each other a little bit.
Yeah.
But she was married. She was essentially an Irish princess who was married to the Duke of Cornwall.
King Marcus,
somewhat against her will. This is where it gets a bit weird, because technically Morgana was actually the Duchess of Cornwall at the same time. So,
yes,
there were two claimants to that particular that particular kingdom.
There are several versions of what occurred, but for those who know the story of Tristan and Isolde, Marcus's nephew, Tristan, went to Ireland to retrieve Princess Isolde and bring her back to marry. The two of them ended up drinking a love potion, which I'm still not entirely sure why they thought that was a good idea.
Yeah.
Presumably the love potion was so that she could fall in love with Marcus, but then Tristan thought, you know what? Let's try it. Let's see what happens. And they fall in love with each other. And even though Isolde then marries Marcus, she continues her affair with Tristan. We go back to Morgana. Told you she was coming back. we can't put her to the side for long. Now, a little bit of history about Morgana, which I'm sure I've said before, but I'm just going to remind you. Morgana was thrown out of the Arthurian court because she had an affair. She was married off at a very young age by Uther Pendragon. Some versions basically state that her husband was abusive, or that she didn't particularly care for him. It was definitely a strategic marriage and not a marriage for love. So she had an affair. We don't ever really know who she had an affair with. But Guinevere, who we will come on to in a minute, Guinevere discovered this and was so horrified that she had Morgana thrown out of court.
Yeah.
Morgana then discovered that Guinevere was having an affair. And again, we'll come to this in a minute. Spoilers, it was with Lancelot. Morgana then spent pretty much the rest of her life trying to take revenge out on Guinevere. And this is something very important, is that much later on in a lot of the versions we see, Morgana's gunning against Arthur. When in the initial legends, Morgana doesn't actually have anything against Arthur at all. She actually seems to quite like Arthur. It's Guinevere she really, really hates. So Morgana begins setting up all these tricks to try and shock Guinevere either into dying or expose her, because she can't tell the truth to her brother for some reason unbeknownst to everyone. And she sends a magic chalice which will expose the truth. Unfortunately, instead of exposing Guinevere, she ends up exposing Tristan and Isolde, which results in Tristan getting exiled and marrying another woman called Isolde, and then dying.
And doesn't Isolde get burnt on a pyre?
In some versions, she gets burnt on a pyre. In another version, as Tristan lies dying, he sends for her. She come sailing in, and they do a very Greek mythology kind of thing, which says if she is coming, put the sails as white, if not, put the sails as black.
Yeah, so we can see where that's come from then.
Yeah, and Tristan's wife, who's very jealous and really rather upset at this moment that even in his dying moments he's thinking about the other Isolde, when Tristan asks what colour are the sails, she lies and she says they're black. Tristan then dies, Isolde arrives, collapses on him, and dies as well from grief.
Yeah. I think it's worth saying at this point that, again, this is the Norman influence, where they liked to... They started off the big tales of courtly love. It wasn't fashionable, for a very good reason, for you to be in love with the person you were married to. And the ideal of courtly love was that you would... This is where the whole sort of wearing somebody's colours into a joust came from. A lady might indicate a secret preference to one of her admirers, but she would never ever act on it. The man would, you know, be very devoted to serving this one lady who was like the personification of everything beautiful and virtuous, but would never act upon it. And it wasn't, they wouldn't marry each other. It wasn't done to be in love with the person. It was actually considered kind of ill-bred to be in love with the person you were married to.
Yeah. It was very much, it was about a pure kind of love. It was a love without carnal desire, or that carnal desire would never, ever be acted upon, ever. And thus we get to Lancelot and Guinevere. Now, the whole story of Lancelot and Guinevere is actually quite interesting, because originally it did start out as a very courtly love sort of affair. And it kind of descends from there. And we talk about those priests coming in, getting all excited. and by excited, I mean getting demonizing Guinevere and demonizing Lancelot, of course, for having for initiating this affair. And it was sort of escalated into a physical affair. And then they created Galahad because they created Galahad out of what Lancelot was supposed to be. Now, the reason I mentioned Galahad, because I'm not actually going to talk about Galahad, is because I want to talk about Galahad's mother.
Yes.
Now, interestingly, so far, every female character we've had has either been unfaithful or a witch. So we get to Elaine. So Elaine of Corbenic was the daughter of the Fisher King. And she came across Lancelot after he rushed away from Camelot half mad with his love for Guinevere and the fact that he couldn't actually be with her. She cured him of his madness. They got married, they had a child, and then Lancelot went off again and continued on with Guinevere and abandoned Elaine.
And I think Elaine kind of dies, doesn't she?
She does totally die.
The Lady of Shalott.
The Lady, yes, poor Lady of Shalott. Interestingly enough, once again, we have this element of magic and the mystery of women. Now, she's not a witch, but there are some versions where she conceives Galahad through trickery by pretending to be, by pretending to be Guinevere.
Yeah, in some versions she's Guinevere's cousin and looks just enough like her that a glamour's possible, and she enlists Morgana's help because she's in love with Lancelot.
Yes. But again, it's this connection with magic, and it's a theme that runs through the entire Arthurian legends, which isn't just magic in general, but magic within women. And magic seems to be it is connected both with women and with the old world. And this is something I find very interesting, because actually the only instance really of a magic male you have, apart from the Green Knight, who is the green man and is therefore connected with the old world, is Merlin, who's a druid, also connected with the old world. So the male figures are connected with this pre-existing world, the old order, the old religions. And therefore you understand why they have these kinds of powers. But the female characters aren't connected in that same way, and yet they have a magic onto themselves, which is both to do with the fact that they're wicked, but also to do with the fact that they're mysterious and unattainable and different.
Yeah.
Tricky. Sorry. My inner golem came out there.
There is an element of that, and I wonder if this is a byproduct of the whole courtly love lie, essentially,
yes.
Whereby, I can't have her and she's making me feel these things kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate because, you know, a lot of witch trials sort of came out of that a few centuries later.
yes, and it is rather difficult. And it's also the holding women up to the impossible standard of being both magical but also very Christian at the same time. But being magical because it was the manic pixie dream. It was ye old manic pixie dream.
Yeah, it absolutely was. And I suppose the people who were doing this were kind of like the incels of their day.
Yes, basically.
It's really sad. There's really nothing new under heaven, is there?
Anyway. So Elaine dies, having given birth to Galahad. Now, usually that would dictate that Galahad would have come out wrong, but apparently it's totally okay for children to be conceived under lies. They can still be completely, you know, magical. As in magically innocent, Arthur was, after all, conceived under disguise as well. So it kind of makes sense that Galahad is too.
But their mothers were married when they gave birth.
Yes, naturally. So we have Elaine. She dies from love. So far, it just seems to be the general thing. Women have their hearts broken. They perish. Which is true in life, obviously. Angels.
You're asking the wrong person.
Yeah. I mean, I perish at any minor inconvenience. It rains, I'm like, oh, and I perish. It's very difficult being a woman. Just death at every corner. Minor cold, perish. Anyway, moving on from Elaine. We should probably talk about Vivian.
Yeah, probably one of the more interesting characters. I have to admit, I come at this from a slightly different angle to Madeline. I come from the more Celtic route, which, you know, I suppose is good because I think you come from more of the middle legend.
Yeah, and yeah, the definitely the more sort of Saxon, not Nordic. What am I trying to say?
Norman.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, we've got no way of knowing whether Vivian actually ever existed, but I think it's quite probable that there was someone who, like her, who existed, who saw the way things were changing. And, you know, let's be clear here, amongst the Celts, women and men were equal.
To the extent that the Romans found it really weird.
Yeah, exactly. And you would have female leaders as... Basically, it was about aptitude as much as anything else. You were considered naturally slightly more attuned with magical forces if you were female because you could give birth. So you were mistress of life and death in that respect. That's not to say that I'm sure there weren't sexism, there wasn't rape and things, but just looking at their punishments for things like rape and paedophilia, one of which was to stake somebody out by their hands and feet on their backs on a platform. For days to leave them for the ravens and crows to peck to death.
Excellent.
So, you know, it's kind of... and the Saxons had some pretty nasty punishments for this sort of thing as well. So it's... We forget that while it's difficult to get convictions, and it always has been, that it wasn't always like a permissive thing. It wasn't considered acceptable. And again, this was something that the Romans found really, really weird.
Very because weird.
They tended to lock their women away if they didn't. Otherwise, unattended women could be interfered with, basically. They weren't valued enough.
Yeah.
So Vivian, or whoever she really was apparently quite a shrewd political player and did not want change in the same way. And she could easily be an echo of people like Boudica or Cartimandua. Mm-hmm. Or any of a number of other Celtic queens or chieftains, or even warriors. And there were female religious leaders as well. I don't think I can really stress how important it is the fact that there was a very strong female-led religious element as well. I mean, nowadays, it's lovely that there is a Druid movement in action now, but they are teddy bears in comparison to what the Druid movement originally was. There's a reason that the Romans, who went everywhere and let people keep their own gods, rooted out the Druids and killed them, absolutely slaughtered them. And that's because while you had war leaders and queens and chieftains and kings, and you had a royal family absolutely in various different parts of Britain, mm-hmm. the Druids really were the real power. They had a superior communication system. They had advanced schools of medicine and learning. I think people forget that because there wasn't a written language that wasn't considered sacred and they didn't write things down, that perhaps they were kind of a bit more primitive than they were, and that wasn't the case. And while we do have horrific descriptions from people like, say, Tacitus, to say that the Druids were basically savages who burnt people alive in wicker cages shaped like men, and they may well have done that, we don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, like, so did the Romans.
Yeah, a lot of that was propaganda, because if you conquer people, you want the next people to hear about your exploits. And you can't come in and say, yes, well, we went in and slaughtered 50 unarmed sheep farmers and expect to scare the shit out of the next lot of people. So you make the people you have conquered monsters.
Yeah.
But having said that, I do not believe for one second the Romans would have bothered to completely eradicate an entire priesthood when it really set them at a disadvantage in many ways, if they hadn't have been a severe threat to Roman occupancy and power.
Yeah.
So there you go. You've got somebody like Vivian or whoever connected with that sort of network of power and influence. And I just find it, you know, there's no way of us knowing, but I just find it really, really fascinating. And she's continued, again, probably in one of the greater portrayals of history and mythology, as this disincarnate entity that lives at the bottom of a lake and bestows mysterious swords on people.
Yes. And again, this is another example, actually, because Vivian is the Lady of the Lake. And then we have a character named Nimue, who sometimes is also then made into Vivian too. And this happens around the sort of the Norman retellings.
Yeah.
Because they were just super uber keen to just get rid of as many female characters as possible.
Yeah.
And just merge them, but also create all these new male characters like Galahad and so forth. This version of Vivian in some of the mythos and some of the writing, she was Saxon. And her entire purpose was really just sort of to mess things up a little bit. In other versions, she is a witch, or she's a sorceress of some kind. And she comes to learn from Merlin. And Merlin tries to get it on with her. And she tricks him into teaching her a binding spell, and then binds him and traps him in a tree or in a cave, depending on the version, and then merrily waltzes off, and that's the last you really hear of her. And this version, it's interesting because Merlin, who's seen as this very noble, very wise figure from very early on, is sort of taken a bit for a ride in this version, sort of drawn in by his lust. And there's two ways that we can read this, in that Merlin ultimately, because of his connections to the old world, was therefore flawed, and must have had a lecherous streak to him, and was also stupid enough to allow himself to get caught, or once again, that it was the responsibility of Vivian as a woman of power who used her mystical ancient arts to be able to trick the smartest person in Camelot.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And it's interesting what it sort of says about the mindset, because there are grains of you know, vague truth that are probably buried in here.
Yeah.
Because traditional punishment for treachery amongst the Celts was imprisonment in an oak tree and then being burnt alive in it.
Yeah.
If that's for a priest who betrayed their vows.
Yeah.
As I said, when I said that the current druid kind of teddy bears, what I mean is they don't tend to punish traitors like this. The original druids weren't particularly nice people. You can't be a shrewd political player and be a nice person. It just, you know, it's those two things are fundamentally incompatible generally.
Yes, it certainly would have been. Yeah, the druids got up to some pretty nasty stuff, let's not lie. Even if giant wicker men, which, you know, were you trap people on fire, even if that wasn't happening, there was some real level of tortures, usually including bogs and disembowelment, and having like live seeds put into your body and sort of pushing roots through and
yeah. it was quite a brutal religion in a lot of ways, and that's not there's a lot of wisdom with it as well, but also it was pretty, I mean, nature is quite brutal and it reflected nature, so
Yeah. These definitely weren't the bearded, sort of bumbling, peaceful people that are sometimes portrayed. Now, druids were pretty action-packed, pretty scary.
Yeah, definitely. So anyway, the whole idea that Vivian or Nimue, I've always read it more as Nimue, but I think that's because I read it from one of the Celtic myths from the Mabinogion. Tricking Merlin into a tree was Merlin had betrayed his vows as a priest, as the highest order of priest, in fact, of the Druids, by allowing Arthur's court to become entirely Christian, and therefore the penalty for that was death.
But of course, in the Norman version as well, they couldn't possibly say that, so she was just wicked, wicked, naughty Vivian. Or he was wicked, wicked, naughty Merlin.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is interesting. I can imagine it's not too hard to, if you think about the possible historical roots and the Celtic mythology behind all the romanticised and not especially pleasant courtly love Norman type stuff that came after. The fact that a woman who has been used to holding religious power equal to a man might find that a man who was her colleague is now betraying his original calling of something they both really believed fundamentally and agreed on to a religion where women had no power.
Yeah.
As being something, well, not necessarily punishable by death, but, you know, being something that was worth taking him up for.
Yeah.
I think you've betrayed our country in this respect. And people, when it comes to beliefs, I mean, belief literally means what we cling to. It's from an Anglo-Saxon word. And when people start messing, it's like, if you think about people messing around with your headcanon over something you've got a real yen for the fandom for, it's like that. That's what religion is, basically.
No.
And people do not have rational responses to that. And very few people seem to be able to pull themselves back in the moment. I mean, obviously, if we have fandoms where people start burning each other alive, trapped in oak trees, then we've got real issues. But
yeah, that should probably be addressed. But I mean, to be honest, we do have fandoms currently that do send death threats. So
yeah.
Sorry. Everyone should probably take a breath, take a step back. But yeah, you can absolutely understand the violence that was happening. And you can also understand why it was rewritten. Because as we said, propaganda was a very large part of the Arthurian myths. Now, I know that we're focusing on women, but we should probably actually look at why the Arthurian myths have been used repeatedly over time and how and why changing them was all propaganda based.
Yeah.
Now, what's your favourite story? Don't answer that, Jules. It would take you a long time, I imagine, to think. What? Can you tell me what your favourite story is?
I've got several. I really, really like the story of the Loathly Lady. I like the story of the Green Knight, just because I find it really funny. And I suppose I do like the stories of Nimue and, you know, Morgana. I mean, she's very, very checkered, but obviously I'm interested in all of those ones.
Yeah. The Arthurian legends have always actually been about the people. And it's about a sense of national pride. Now, we don't really know where they originated, but they are probably old, like old as balls, super old, okay? We're talking Celtic pre-Roman invasion time. We have very similar stories across the Irish Sea, obviously in Ireland, with the Fianna and Fan Macul. The Arthurian legends are tied with the Mabinogion. We have spots and bits and pieces of them all over the British Isles and even across in other Celtic areas, including France. I mean, France is actually, Lancelot is technically from France. But then again, Norman influence, what can you do?
Except it used to be called Less Britain then.
Less Britain.
That part of France that he was from was called Less Britain. I think we now call it Brittany.
Yes. So basically the wet part. What? It's true.
Are you suggesting that rain is a British import to France?
Are you suggesting it isn't?
I wouldn't go that far.
Anyway, it was a lot to do with national pride, and it was always this level of propaganda. But when we look at the original, and we look at Finn McCool, we have Finn was the head of the Fianna, but they were all equal. He wasn't actually the king. As things shifted over, however, the higher power stopped being a literal king and became a god, especially when we had the Norman influence coming into it.
Yes.
The whole story, however, is about invasion in one form or another, and that has continued throughout. And it was, as I said, about this national pride and this national identity. But in much the same way that invaders came in and changed gods and religion by basically adapting them to suit their current politics and their current religions, it happened with the Arthurian legends. So with each new invader, Arthur changed, and so did his knights. He probably went from being a very sort of a commander and a general to a king, and the myths continued, taking little bits and pieces from different mythos as time went by. And that's why we can actually really take a guess of where certain elements of the mythos came from, depending on who was invading at the time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there is a parallel from the tales of Brede, who was a Brittany chieftain in Scotland, except it wasn't called Scotland back then, because the Scots hadn't arrived yet. That's really interesting, and it feeds into all these Celtic and proto-Celtic myths. The idea that it wasn't Brede's children who would go on to be his heirs, it would have been his sister's heirs. He didn't have a sister, therefore his initial stab at being elected as king, because we elected our kings originally, which again supports your idea of being war leaders more than actual rulers in the royal family. It weakened his claim because he didn't have a sister. And then you add the fact that, yes, he was elected anyway because he was just a brilliant strategist. But when his term of office as king or war leader came to an end, he was they elected another king. And this is something the Saxons did. The Saxons held witnagemots in order to elect kings. We forget that it hasn't always been a case of there's a royal family and they're set above us and they're set there by God. Actually, no, we elected the person who was considered most apt out of probably a set of fairly privileged individuals, because they generally were educated and they'd been taught to fight and ride, etc. And they'd been
well
fed.
And to be honest, you probably would want someone relatively educated to be the king.
You would, to be honest, because otherwise you want your best opportunity, really, if they're going to be a war leader. And the Celts, again, elected their chieftains and their queens and their kings, etc. So you'd have several claimants and you would elect from the best, ideally, or the best of what you were offered. And then the Normans came along and just completely ended that way of life. That was it. There was no more elected kingship. In fact, it was so anathema to them, they stamped out as much of that in historical record as possible.
And so we have the story of Arthur coming, actually being the heir and not just chosen by what later became God, because he pulled a sword from a stone, when actually probably the original was that Arthur was a blacksmith and he pulled the sword from the stone, in that he was one of the first few people basically during what became the Iron Age, well, not the Iron Age, but you know what I mean, to actually sort of harness this new material for war and for battle and for protection, and was then elected. So they changed that. And of course, it couldn't just be then that Arthur was from a community, and he was a squire and he came into his own power, it was that he did all of these things, but also, hey, lo and behold, he was actually the son of the rightful king.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that feeds very nicely for the Normans into this idea that there is a chosen royal line and they're set there by God, you know?
Yes. Now, we should probably talk about Arthur's mother.
Yeah, we should talk about Ygraine, because again, that's another interesting character, and she does kind of straddle the Celtic mythology side of it and the new romantic side of it.
Yeah. Ygraine kind of has a bad lot of it, really.
Yeah, I mean, she's married off to Goliath at about sort of 13, 14 to bridge the gap when the Romans were still occupying Britain between the original Britons and, you know, the Romans. And she was part of what was considered the Celtic royal line.
Yeah. She gave birth, well, it's different reports, different stories, but she gave birth to three daughters by Goliath. One of which was, of course, Morgana.
Yes.
At this point in time, Uther Pendragon sees Ygraine and goes, wow. I love her. Merlin. And Merlin goes, oh, okay. And so he disguises Uther Pendragon as Goliath. Goliath goes into the castle on the same night that, Uther goes into the castle, disguises Goliath on the same night that Goliath, who he was actually, the pair of them were actually working together. I say working together, not in this instance, but they were on the same side, were they?
Well,
in some
yeah,
versions they were.
That's the interesting thing, is that the old king, who was, you know, Roman Britain by birth, had just died, and they needed somebody who could unite the Romans who'd remained in Britain, and the Celts, and the Earth's people, and the Prytani. And Uther was actually the best case. So Goliath had just thrown his lot in and said, okay, I don't really like the guy that much. You know, he's sort of everything I don't like in a bloke, but I'm throwing my lot in behind him. And then completely betrays it all in a jealous fit when he sees that Uther's checking out his wife.
Yes. At which point, on the very night that Goliath is getting murdered, Uther is getting it on with his wife. So that's a bit harsh.
Well, it is a bit harsh, but technically Goliath has just betrayed his vows to the king, and the punishment for that was death. You know, the Celts were pretty unequivocal about all this stuff.
Yeah, definitely. But it's also the fact that, yeah, Uther wasn't even on the battleground. Uther was just getting it on with Goliath's wife. And Ygraine thought that it was her husband. So, basically, Arthur was conceived via unconsensual sex, aka rape. So, that's how we start his story.
Yeah, the thing is, I don't actually buy that. I refuse. I think it's that's how, again, that's Norman spin doctoring.
Yeah. So, what do you think?
I think in the original, she knew exactly who he was. He might have disguised himself to get in past the guards, but I think he'd already had the fight with Goliath and sort of turned up to say, by the way, your husband's dead, but I have an offer to make you. And Ygraine was either politically motivated to accept him because, hey, she got to be queen, or she was kind of like, actually, I've kind of been checking you out as well, so I'm
yeah.
not good with this.
And to be honest, I was married off to this guy. And
I was like 13, 14 at the time, and I'm glad he's gone.
Yeah.
All things that the Normans would not want women to be shown feeling and thinking in
yeah.
their own legends.
Yeah. This is particularly supported by the fact that Ygraine does then marry Uther. Now, you could argue she does it out of sense of, well, I'm pregnant now, it's the only thing I can do. Or whether she actually wanted to do it remains to be seen. They give birth to Arthur. I say they, obviously Uther had nothing to do with it.
Well, he had about 15 minutes to do with it.
Well, yeah, I think you're being kind. I'm sorry, I don't have a lot of affection for Uther.
See, when you compare him to some of the other men who turn up, I actually don't think he's that bad.
He's not that bad. But anyway, they give birth to Arthur, and Ygraine completely disappears from the story. She has served her purpose.
Well, there are other reports, though, where she turns up, she goes to live in a nunnery, because Morgana is sent to live in a nunnery, apparently, for a bit as well, as a young girl. That's where she's educated.
Yeah, she's sent to live in a nunnery because she got it on and Guinevere got angry, so she was basically locked away.
But once Uther dies, Igraine retires to a nunnery, apparently. But in some legends, you actually see Arthur sending her to collect Guinevere, because he hasn't even met her at that point. And, you know, I'm sending my mother to accompany you is kind of like an honour as much as anything else. But, and Igraine having grave, grave misgivings about Guinevere as a suitable wife.
Yeah.
Then if you, in sort of the original mythology, Guinevere was a queen in her own right and wasn't married off against her will or against her inclination. It was a shrewd political move to unite their kingdoms.
Yeah. Guinevere has changed as time has gone by. She became much less shrewd, much less intelligent, a lot more of the innocent girl who didn't really know what was going on. And the age gap between the two of them has sort of increased. And you see the increase, especially in artwork as well. Possibly because, heaven forbid, there be a middle-aged woman. Arthur is depicted as, you know, getting old with a beard and stuff like that, and Guinevere still looks like she's in her 20s. But in the original mythos, as you say, she was a queen unto her own right, whereas as time has gone by, and again we have the Normans, there was also the fact that women could not wield the same amount of power as men.
No, absolutely not. And
the only way she could have been a queen would have been if she was married to a king. She couldn't have been a queen in her own right according to the Norman law, really.
No. No, absolutely. And you're right again with the whole sort of she becomes less of a powerhouse in her own right, whereas if you read, you know, the fragments of the original myth that still exist, she is kind of a powerhouse in her own right. There's one in particular that makes me laugh from the Mabinogion where Arthur's had a quarrel with Gawain. Gawain throws Arthur into the river because Gawain's a bit hot-tempered. Arthur comes out in his nice clothes, absolutely soaked and covered in pondweed, and Guinevere's furious and turns on Gawain and really tells him off in front of everyone. It's very, very funny. Just because it's so unexpected. I mean, there's all these weird tales in the middle of the map, and then you get to the middle of the Mabinogion and there's this tale of Arthur where he's got his clothes wet and Guinevere's furious about it because she wants him to look nice for that occasion. But you're right, yeah, she becomes less of a powerhouse. I think that is partly to do with the Normans, and then partly, again, a couple of centuries later, to do with the fact that they made her personify perfect womanhood.
Yeah.
Unspoiled by the touch of any man, kind of thing. And the whole point of that was then so that they could show what happened when that ideal fell.
Yes. And what corruption essentially looked like.
Yeah.
Yes.
We have once again bitten off more than we can chew.
We definitely have. But we seem to have covered at least the most prominent female figures in our theory.
We've managed 9. I feel that we have shortchanged Morgause, so we should come back to her at some point in the future.
Yeah, we should probably return to her at some point. We haven't even mentioned the other sister, whose name changes periodically.
Yeah.
Yes.
Basically, Arthurian mythology, if you want to be an Arthurian scholar, there is a lot of material because people have been writing fanfic of it for centuries.
Really, really long time.
Strap yourself in.
Now, before we go, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this time it's me. Yay! So I've been reading a very interesting series called, well, the first book is called Illuminae. And it's by Amy Kaufman and Jay Kristoff. The same Jay Kristoff who wrote Nevernight. It's sci-fi, so shock horror, I know. Me reading sci-fi is not usual. And at some point, we're going to get a guest on and we're going to talk a little bit more about Illuminae, and what makes it so unique and interesting. But there's a really great visual aspect to Illuminate, which you kind of have to see to understand. I'm really, really enjoying it. I haven't finished it yet. It's equal parts dark. The storytelling is interesting. Not sure how much I really like the main female character, but she's definitely very fleshed out. And the humour is really fantastic. 10 out of 10 for that. My heart has already been broken. I'm barely like a third of the way through. So that's my recommendation for the week. And I actually don't think Jules has read it yet.
No, I've got all three books and they are on my TBR, you know, which one day is going to fall on me and kill me. So I will get to them at some point.
Is this before or after it falls on you? As it falls on you. Oh, okay.
I probably would read something on the way down. Yeah,
it's just the idea that as you're being crushed, it's fallen open, so you might as well read the page while you die.
I mean, I can think of worse ways to go, to be honest.
Jules' nightmare. She gets to the end of the page before she dies. Turn! Turn! Damn it, turn! And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.